Welcome, and thanks for listening to Explore Cell Therapy, where hematology, oncology, and transplant experts examine practice-changing research and hot topics in hematopoietic cell transplant and other cell therapies. I'm your host, Sam Waters, provider education and research lead at NMDP. In this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Rachel Phelan of the Medical College of Wisconsin and Dr. Rafiq Youssef of NMDP, who both act as scientific directors for the CIBMTR, or Center for International Blood and Marrow Transplant Research. Together, we discuss the results of a recent CIBMTR report examining trends in allogeneic transplant by race and ethnicity. We explore the advances in transplant that have helped to close gaps in equity, as well as the multifaceted barriers that continue to hinder equitable access and outcomes. To learn more about our guests and access additional resources related to today's episode, click the link in the episode description. This is part two of a two-part episode. As they're traveling throughout this transplant journey from pre-transplant considerations to the transplant center and then back to a hematology oncology practice or a local community doctor or even a primary care physician, I'm curious to hear your thoughts about that continuum of care and how care coordination plays a role in access and outcomes to transplant and can help encourage equity? It's a big question.
Honestly, to me, it's music to my ears in the sense that I'm an advocate of, care coordination, and I think more of it needs to be done within the TCT ecosystem, in the sense that, I've had community hematology oncologists say that, part of the reasons why they don't refer their patients is that once you get to the transplant centers, there's no feedback loop. They don't know what's happening to those patients. They no longer have access to those patients. And I think, transplant centers do a lot of work. They take on a lot. And I think that burden should be shared, in the sense that there's opportunity to look at, what's the capacity and the capabilities of hematology oncologists, such that we're looking at it in the direction of referral. Then we should look at it in terms of post-transplant care. I had, previous to this had to do with mental health, and it was in the setting of the VA where, they were trying to get veterans with mental health challenges back to their PCPs, away from the psychiatrists. One, it frees space for the psychiatrists to see newer, patients, and also that continuity of care continues even post-transplant. So I think there needs to be improved coordination of care, such that you close that loop completely. It's critical. I know there have been, talks around patient-centered medical health model of care, where your patient is at the middle and you have all the specialties coming together. But that being said, all of this has to do also with funding and who's going to pay for that and resources. So that is also an important issue to consider when we're thinking of the care coordination, but nonetheless, it's very crucial.
Yeah, I think to piggyback on that, Rafiq, it's funding and then it's also time, right? Mm-hmm. It's so important to take that time, have that communication with the referring doctor. Also, ideally have some sort of communication with the primary care provider, right? And we know that primary care providers are seeing patients every 10 to 15 minutes sometimes, seeing one of our really complex patients. I can't even imagine how difficult and intimidating and everything that can be. And, transitions of care are really hard, and there's lots of ways that can be improved and a lot of different ideas out there for doing that, like survivorship care plans. And I think the use of telemedicine could be something that is utilized more now that we've all become comfortable and used it a lot more, since the pandemic. But there's lots of different ways that we can communicate with the patient, the caregiver, and the providers that they're going back to. And that really, does need to be an emphasis in that care coordination along the journey at various different time points is really, really important. And we don't want to hear from the person who's referring a patient to us that they don't know what's happening. And then all of a sudden they show back up at their door, right? Mm-hmm. And they might not know what to look for in terms of complications, right? What does graft versus host disease look like? Do they still need these medications? When can I stop them? All of those types of things. We really need to make sure that we are good at communicating, with all the key providers.
Oh no, I was just, I remember being at a seminar where a transplant physician was saying that as part of, the post-transplant care for their patients, they actually, take the care to where the patients are located, where they are situated. So that, that they take the care to them and that, that barrier of transportation, having to make it or losing the patient to follow up attrition is reduced such that, they have that interaction even at, as you said, Rachel, at the referring physician level and the primary care provider level, where there's that communication. And I can imagine how, beneficial it's going to be to the patients.
No, and I can imagine that having that sort of unified voice and clear coordination between everyone who's a part of your healthcare team would make the process of accepting a transplant consultation, switching doctors, switching centers, going through this whole additional scary process a little bit less daunting to know, oh yes, this is, my transplant physician and my hematologist oncologist are communicating with each other. They have a clear unified vision for my care plan and my health, and I trust this provider, so I trust my new provider, is that something that you see in practice, Dr. Phelan, or?
Oh yes, definitely. Yep. All the time. Of course it's convenient if the hematologist or oncologist is here and we can sometimes have joint meetings with the patient, right? We can have joint follow-up where the oncologist or hematologist, can just pop in and say hi and see how things are going. We oftentimes have joint meetings to talk about patients, but we also, have explored ways to have meetings with regional providers, right, where we talk about patients that might get referred and, again, start that communication early. And then when they are able to transition back, I have an email that I can reach out to, right? I have a phone number. I have that the nurse's, way to contact her and who to send data to and information. It really makes a huge difference in care coordination for the patient. And like you said, or kind of inferred, like that whole trust of care, right? And comfort, because you don't want the patient to have additional stress in terms of who's going to take care of me afterwards. And do I need to tell this other person this whole story of what happened in my life when I was undergoing the transplant, for a couple of months? Because that's a lot to have to remember and relay, and that shouldn't be on the patient. And so, optimizing that communication is really, important.
I mean, I agree. And, you know, like you mentioned, the teleconsult with provider and patient, there can also be a teleconsult or telecommunication between provider to provider, you know, such that you would at least you reduce that distance. I mean, it's more of a click away or a button, push up a button away. So I think it's the willingness to want to, you know, to do this, that is critical, because once we understand that it's important and it's going to benefit the patient, I think we can make it happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and making it really clear whose job is it to do a particular thing, right, I think has also been really important, at least when I'm transitioning patients to a different provider. You know, who is going to be ordering that echocardiogram and making sure it happens? Who's going to be arranging that bone marrow biopsy? Are they coming back here or getting it done with you? And are you going to help me interpret those chimerism results, because it's not something I typically send, right? Those are all important conversations to have when planning ahead.
No, it's fantastic to hear that that you're doing so much of that work to help explore new ways to keep those communication channels open and, you know, make sure that coordination of care exists. So thinking a little bit about how we can apply the findings of this report, you know, this is trends in access and outcomes, and they're very important to monitor to see, you know, how we're doing in closing those gaps and how practice is changing in the real world. But we'd love to hear your thoughts on what hematology oncology providers and transplant center providers can be taking away from this report to kind of take into their practice and really think about being advocates for equity at their centers.
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, the fact that we did this study highlights how important it is, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, that we focused in on how are we doing in providing access to every patient. And, you know, we have seen trends and improvement over time. But like I said, I think that there's still a lot of room. And we looked at the years 2010 to 2020. And 2020 might not be fair. I think we all know what happened in 2020. We saw transplant numbers in general dip. And so it's really important that we looked at this. We're continuing to look at this. And we should probably look at it again in 5 years, right? Are we making improvements in the direction that we anticipate? Are we getting the word out that we're able to offer different types of transplants to patients that might not have a traditional, you know, match in the registry or a match sibling donor. So this is really critical data to look at and should be looked at again and kind of on a continual basis.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And, you know, to extend it a bit more, that, you know, we've seen the results, you know, what this analysis provides. And we also have an understanding or insight into what it doesn't provide, you know. So it's going to be important that all stakeholders, whether they're directly or indirectly involved with patient care, you know, patients with hematologic disorders, there's need to understand what are those modifiable and, you know, non-modifiable factors that, you know, impact patients from getting the care that they need. And I think beyond sex, beyond race, beyond ethnicity, I think there's that critical need to understand how, where patients are born, where they live, where they grow, where they learn, where they work, where they age, how it affects, you know, their access to utilization of these services and overall their survival, their quality of life, their life expectancy. And finally, for them to understand that, look, it doesn't rest on the healthcare system alone. It's multifaceted, as we've been seeing, you know, such that the opportunity to be able to think out of the box. I know life happens and it's easy for us to zone in on our own area, but I think the opportunity to be able to think far and wide in terms of what are the far-reaching implications of what we do or what we don't do is important.
Right. I think that's really critical, Rafiq. You know, we have a lot of data at CIBMTR and NMDP that we can look at, but there's also gaps in what we collect. And you know, if we do see this plateau in access to transplant, that also might be a signal that we're missing something critical, right? So that's why it's really important for us to, again, look at the whole patient, the whole family unit, their entire journey, what we can improve upon. Rafiq has such great insight into this area, and you know, all the different points that you brought up are just so interesting. You know, the incarceration rates and the access to donors, right? All of the cultural things that many may not be aware of. So just really important to think about all of those things as clinicians and researchers.
I think it's also important to acknowledge the progress as well, and the progress that has been made and continues to be made in the space. I know before we were talking a lot about alternative donor options like haploidentical transplant and now mismatched unrelated donor transplant. I am curious to revisit that a little bit. I'd love to hear your thoughts around sort of the differences in uptake for the two alternative donor sources and where you see the future headed. Do you think, you know, mismatch unrelated donors are going to continue to increase even more so now, or is haploidentical transplant, you know, still kind of king according to the trends that you're seeing? Really curious to hear your thoughts on where that field is going.
Yeah. Interesting question. I mean, you know, it's all speculation, but I personally don't see haploidentical transplantation slowing down. I think, you know, as amazing as our field is, which of course is why I went into it, right? We always have all these amazing advances, cellular therapy, ways that we perform transplantation. All of that is really cool and exciting. But we also, when we find something that works, we maybe want to stick with that for a while and see what we can do to modify that in some ways, right? And I think that with haploidentical transplantation, there's a lot of convenience at times in terms of having potentially a family member that's at the ready that we can use, at least in pediatrics. I'm speaking from a pediatrician perspective as well. Having somebody there that's willing to be a donor and, you know, can easily give us that donation when we want it. So that convenience factor, I think, plays into probably some of the trends that we see as well. But at the same time, with other, you know, not only PTCy, and I talked about, you know, alpha beta T cell depletion, there's also other, you know, drugs on the market that I think may make a difference in our utilization of mismatched unrelated donor transplants as well. So things like abatacept and, you know, that is just one that comes to mind that has also made it easier to use these different types of mismatched donors. I think we're probably going to see an upward trend of both, but my prediction is that upward trend of haploidentical might be a little bit quicker. But as we all get more used to using more and more mismatched unrelated donors, we'll see who wins the race over time.
I mean, I honestly share sentiments, Rachel, and I think, you know, we should see it as collaborative or complementary rather than adversarial or competitive. Because
right, that's true. They're both winners in the end, right? As long as our patients do well.
Exactly, because even as there's been that significant shift from cord blood, cord blood still has a niche that it caters to. And it's still, you know, relevant to as a graft source. So I think it's more of, you know, where interests lie. But, you know, we shouldn't let that blind us to the benefit of the existing opportunities or donor sources or graft sources or platforms. So I think it can only get better. I mean, we've come a long way. Now we're talking about, it's amazing. I think, yes, healthy competition is fine. Don't get me wrong, but I think it should be more, yes.
It helps us to advance, right? Exactly. To challenge each other.
Yep.
I was talking to a colleague of mine this morning about a really difficult patient case. And one of the things that's difficult about it is that there are so many options, right? You know, sometimes you only have one choice for how to treat a patient, but in this particular situation, there's multiple donor options, there's multiple conditioning options, right? All of those things have to be considered. You know, it's a good problem to have, right? In a lot of ways, but it's, you know, there's oftentimes not a right or wrong. There's still a lot that has to be learned and, complementary healthy competition sometimes helps to drive the field forward. So, yep, there's a role for, I think, just like Rafiq said, all of those different donor types. And we certainly see that in my clinical practice. We talk about all of them when we're assessing a patient and their particular situation. So still lots to be learned and lots of excitement for the future.
Yes. And I do think that more and more research is evolving in that space of, you know, given a particular case, what is the ideal graft source? You know, if you have all of the options in front of you, you know, what should be option 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, that sort of thing. And like you said, there's not necessarily a right or wrong, but sort of optimizing those sources and understanding the pros and the cons, I guess, of each decision. I think a lot more research in the future that'll be done in that space as well.
Yeah, it's fascinating because as you say that, Sam, I think about, you know, this concept of precision donation, precision donor, and, you know, precision TCT. And yes, because where it's not a case of one size fits all, but you tailor it and target it to the need of a specific patient. It's amazing. The possibilities are endless.
Right. And everything's changing so quickly. So it's an exciting time.
It is. Yeah. And that sort of brings me to my typical closer question that I ask, and I like to hear from each of you on this, is what is something you are, like, the one thing you're most excited about for the future of the field to try to continue to close these gaps in equity? And what is the one big thing that you want to make sure everyone who's listening really takes away from this discussion today?
Oh, yeah, what a big question.
Exactly.
It is a big question, but yeah. It helps cut down to the core, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I guess I can try to start. I think one of the things that I'm really excited about that we were just touching about is the personalization of care for the patient. And I think part of that personalization that I'm hoping for the future is actually the ability to decrease the toxicity of the exposures that the patients have related to their underlying diagnosis and subsequent transplantation. And, you know, obviously I'm a little bit biased because my focus, my research and clinical care is on taking care of those long-term survivors who are now, you know, 10, 20 years after their treatment. But the ability to personalize things so that we see decreased rates of subsequent neoplasms, we're able to maintain their fertility if they want to have families that way, right? All of those things are really important. And I think that as we personalize care for patients and we continue to develop treatments that are less toxic, we'll start to see more and more improvements in that. And then also personalized care includes, you know, care for everyone. So I think that's, you know, one of the key takeaways from this study, right? We are making progress. Like you said, let's take an optimistic viewpoint of it because our field is so exciting. We saw from this study that we are offering transplants to more patients, no matter what their race or ethnicity. And so tailoring their entire journey from diagnosis to survivorship is critical, and it has to be personalized to be successful. In our field, we can't have a cookbook recipe that we use for everyone because everyone has their differences, not only in their particular disease and their response to the treatments that we give them, but their ability to pursue transplant, their willingness to enroll on a clinical trial, you know, their capabilities to, you know, care for themselves or to have a support system, and, you know, to absorb how important it is for them to continue to take care of themselves in different ways than the general population for the rest of their lives. All of those things are really different for everyone. And there's so many different things that can be done to improve all of those aspects and so much research that can be done in all those different things. So it's an exciting time in our field, and I'm excited for all of us to continue to learn more in the years to come, how to improve access and how to personalize that care for every patient. So there
honestly,
you go.
Very well said, Rachel. I'll just piggyback off of the fact that, you know, in the process of understanding those differences and using those differences to help personalize medicine or the care that we give, you know, in this area of specialization, we need to have an in-depth understanding of where patients are born, where they live, where they grow, where they learn, where they work, play, and age, and how we can harness that knowledge to help further personalize the care that we give so that ultimately will help improve overall survival, quality of life, life expectancy for our patients.
Right. It's like we focus on, right, the specific cytogenetics of their leukemia that they're being treated for. It's almost like we need to get to that depth for their entire, you know, social construct and all of that as well to really, you know, improve that care substantially.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. This has been a really amazing discussion, and I hope it can help draw more attention to how equity in transplant is evolving and how access to care is improving, and then places that we need to continue to strive to make progress. So I can't thank you enough for your time today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It was great to speak with you, Sam, and to have some back and forth, Rafiq.
Yeah, thank you so much for the opportunity. And I think It's interesting what, you know, to look at next steps and what will come out of the, this field and area of specialization. But thank you for hearing us talk and banter.
Of course.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Explore Cell Therapy. For more information and to access research and resources related to this episode, be sure to click the link in the episode description. Until next time on Explore Cell Therapy.